Sunny skies at 85 degrees. Welcome to this Wednesday edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. We'll begin with this. Mourners gathered to honor Heather Heyer, who was killed after a car rammed into a crowd of people counter-protesting a white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. Mark Heyer spoke of his daughter at the memorial.
No father should have to do this. But I love my daughter. And as I look out on you guys, you loved her too. She was kind of hard that way. It's hard not to love.
Meanwhile, here in Atlanta, while endorsing a mayoral candidate, Ambassador and former mayor Andrew Young was asked about the events in Charlottesville and Confederate symbols. Young gave a timeline of the state and city's battle about preserving Confederate history.
The Confederate flag cost us about $25 billion in Georgia. And it cost us $14.9 billion and 70,000 jobs that would have gone with the Affordable Care Act, which we probably would have had if we hadn't been fighting over the flag. It cost us a Mercedes plant down in the 1st Congressional District that would have been about 3,000 jobs. It cost us the health of our city, because we were prepared to build a northern arc 65 miles from the center of the city of Atlanta, around the perimeter, an outer perimeter that would have been up and running now. We had not been fighting over the flag and lost the governor's race. So I'm always interested in substance over symbol.
And you can hear more from Ambassador Young and fellow civil rights pioneer Dr. C.T. Vivian later today during All Things Considered with Amy Kiley. This is Closer Look. And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. Last November, Georgia voters said no to a constitutional amendment regarding Governor Nathan Deal's plan for an opportunity school district. And the district would have allowed the state to take over schools it deemed as low performing, or as some say, failing. But after failing to get enough votes to support the measure, Governor Deal was able to come up with a plan B, so to speak. That B was for a new bill, House Bill 338, to be exact, that the governor signed into law early this year. Known as the First Priority Act, the law creates a new position called the Chief Turnaround Officer, and that person will report to the State Board of Education. It also called for the creation of the Education Turnaround Advisory Council. Yes, they're tasked with helping in the search for the Chief Turnaround Officer. Joining me now in studio is the chairman of the Education Turnaround Advisory Council, Dr. Jimmy Stokes. He's also the executive director of the Georgia Association of Educational Leaders. Dr. Stokes, welcome. It's a pleasure. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Rose. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, we were talking about football coming into the segment, but we'll switch to education here. Let's talk about, and before we get into the details of what the council was looking for, tell me about who's on this council, who's on this advisory council. And I believe it's 11 members, correct?
That is correct. The advisory council, by legislation, contains the leaders of many of the professional organizations in the state of Georgia. And then the lieutenant governor and the governor were given the opportunity to appoint persons to the commission as well. In fact, Dr. Maria Christofferson, who is from the Atlanta City Schools, was appointed by Chairman, Speaker of the House, David Ralston, mm-hmm. and she serves on the committee. But we have a variety of folks who have a wealth of experience. We have professional educators. We have folks who are well outside the education community, like Kim Evans, who is the director of the Boys and Girls Club mm-hmm. in Richmond County. And we have representatives from folks that represent the classic public schools as well as charter schools. We have Dr. Cassandra Washington, who is the executive director of the Career Technical Academy in Bibb County, mm-hmm. in Macon, and so and that's a charter school. So we've got a variety of folks who serve on the council.
And how important is that to have this variety of folks on this council?
We have to have a variety because the schools that we're going to serve, the traditional low-performing schools, are diverse. They're not all from the same boat. They're not all on the same street, and they look very different. And so we need different faces and different attitudes to be able to create a plan and a program that will serve those schools.
Well, let's get into the plan and the program. Now, you all are not conducting the search, but you're helping with the search. So are you coming up with a plan that will help identify the strengths and the characteristics of this chief turnaround position?
Yes, we are. The State Board of Education, of course, will make the final decision with regard to who the chief turnaround officer will be. But from the very beginning, the State Board said, we want this to be a national search. We do not want this to be a political appointment. We want someone who has experience turning around schools and someone who has experience leading. And so that was the ground level for where we began. We all agreed to contract with the National Association of State School Board, State Boards of Education, mm-hmm. to do the mechanics of the search, much like the Georgia School Boards Association conducts searches for superintendents in the state of Georgia. But NASB is going to be responsible for doing the mechanics of the search. They have advertised the position. They have received applicants to this point. As of last week, there were about 36 applicants, many of which are very well qualified mm-hmm. and come from places outside of Georgia as well as within Georgia as well. And then once we have this cadre of candidates, NASB, the officers at NASB who are experienced in doing these kinds of searches, they will pare the number of applicants down to about 15. Mm-hmm. And then a subcommittee of the council and a subcommittee of the State Board of Education will then interview all 15 candidates that are remaining. And then once those 15 have been interviewed, then they will make a decision to recommend 3 to 5 candidates to the entire council and to the entire board. And those 3 to 5 candidates will interview with the entire council and with the entire board. The council will then make a recommendation to the State Board of Education, and the State Board will make the final decision.
Going from 36 to 3 to 5 final candidates, and you don't want to give too much away, but what are you hoping the characteristics will be of those 3 to 5 candidates? Should they, one, for example, should they be an educator?
We expect them to be an educator. That does not rule out someone who has that outstanding leadership capability, mm-hmm. but we expect them to be an educator. We spent, as a council, in conjunction with a subcommittee of the State Board, we spent a good bit of time finalizing what we really expected from, or really continue to expect from the chief turnaround officer. And we expect them to have some educational experience, particularly with low-performing schools. And we also look for someone who has experience dealing with poverty situations. One of the wonderful things about the underperforming schools in the state of Georgia is that every one of the underperforming schools exceed the state average for free and reduced lunch.
We've talked about that on numerous occasions right here on this program. Some folks may not realize that when you talk about low-performing schools, many of them, as you just said, are housed in low poverty or high poverty areas, whether it's rural or urban, correct?
That is exactly right. And just going in and telling these folks, hey, you got to do better. And if you don't do better, we're going to shut you down. That doesn't work. We've got to go in and provide the nurturing atmosphere that will cause these people to grow and grow in a very positive direction.
Dr. Stokes, you say that, and I'm going to ask you this. Do you think that should have been more of the message, or maybe that message just didn't come across to voters in terms of what exactly Governor Deal's turnaround plan was going to be, because it failed. I mean, it failed miserably, let's just be honest. Do you think that, it may be in the past, but I'm curious, do you think that message maybe just was not presented well so people could really understand what the state wanted to do, as opposed to it sounding like they're going to come in and take over the schools?
Rose, I have to be very honest and say that's what we're doing now. The governor's original proposal was to go in and take over the schools and basically go in with a large stick and say, you're either going to perform or we're going to shut you down. And that was rejected by the voters across the state.
Mm-hmm.
I want to give a real heads up and a vote of thanks to Representative Kevin Tanner, who chaired the process of getting House Bill 338 through. He talked to every professional organization, every teacher group, every group of folks that would talk to him about what would work and what do people need. And he came up with this plan, and he sold it to the governor. And the governor, I'll have to say that I really appreciate the way he has done it. And he said, okay, if we're going to do it this way, mm-hmm. then what we're going to have to do is put resources in these schools.
Which is what schools and school districts have been screaming for ever.
Since Jesus was at East Jesus High School.
He could have went to West. How do you know he went to East?
Anyway. It's interesting that in the state of North Carolina, they have done this very thing.
Mm-hmm.
They have gone into the low-performing schools and low-performing school districts, and they have plied them with resources, whether it be additional teachers, whether it be mental health professionals, whatever they need, they went in and put it into those schools and school systems, and they've seen amazing results. In House Bill 338 and the accompanying legislation that went along with it, Governor Deal stepped up to the plate and said, we will put $4 million in the budget for next year to cover the cost of the initial cost of these schools.
Mm-hmm.
He put $1 million in the fiscal year 17 budget, what we refer to as the supplemental budget. He put $1 million in there to cover the cost of the initial startup and the administration. In addition to that, the legislature passed a bill which will establish a foundation which will contribute an additional $5 million for those low-performing schools. And so that means that we're really going to have about $10 million that we can use to help these schools turn around. And they're low-poverty schools. They need help. They need resources.
And when you talk about needs and resources, you're referring to wraparound services that we hear a lot about that the students need, that the community needs, because the school is the foundation for many neighborhoods. The school is the foundation of the neighborhood.
That's exactly right.
And so if you're talking about putting these resources into the school, into the neighborhood, is $10 million enough, considering how many schools were initially cited on that list?
They can't do them all at one time.
Sure.
We won't select them. The chief turnaround officer will select them. But there'll probably be 10 to 15 schools in the initial phase. And so we've got basically $10 million to deal with 10 to 15 schools. I think that's enough.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at what Marietta City Schools has done in the creation of their wraparound program that they offer to their students,
mm-hmm.
they've done it with a lot less money than that. But very interestingly, I heard Dr. James Jones speak this summer. Dr. Jones is the principal of Stone Mountain High School, and he turned that school around. And he talked about the fact that you've got to involve the community. And this has got to be a total effort. And it's not just about coursework. It's not just about assignments. It is about people supporting people. Mm-hmm. It is about people encouraging people and setting high expectations for folks. And just like he said, and that expectation starts at the top.
The voice you hear is Dr. Jimmy Stokes, chairman of the state's Education Turnaround Advisory Council. With this chief turnaround officer particularly coming from outside the state, do you have any concerns that he or she may not truly understand some of the issues facing kids in the urban districts, kids in the rural district, and being able to, you said you phase one, so you want to make sure there's equity in terms of who's getting what. You can't put everything toward maybe the urban schools. You don't want to leave out the rural schools. Do you have any concerns about this person being able to fully understand the haves and have-nots here in Georgia?
I don't think so, Rose. We wouldn't select a person like that.
Mm-hmm.
Two of the things that we're looking most for is someone who has compassion and understanding and experience with poverty students. That's first. Second is they've got to be a gifted communicator, because they're going to have to convince the communities to change what they're doing. And they're going to have to be able to convince legislators and the governor and everyone else about these are the things that we're going to have to do to make this program successful.
I want to focus on the Atlanta Public Schools for a moment because they have had their own transformation plan. We've talked to Dr. Kirstoffen about it. They've been planning this even before voters went to the polls in November for a district like APS that has their own plan. And Governor Deal actually praised it for a moment there. Will this turnaround officer focus heavily on a district that already has some plans? Will they still be eligible to receive some of the resources that you all are offering? Or are you going to focus on districts that may not quite have that plan together?
I really believe that the focus will be based on all schools. And I certainly believe that Atlanta Public Schools will be included in that. Atlanta Public Schools has a lot of schools. They have a lot of schools that are in poverty. And they can't service them all. And so they need help, just like the folks in Richmond County, just like the folks in Bibb County, just like the folks in Muskogee County that have high impacted urban poverty. And so I really believe that we're going to have someone who can initially deal with urban poverty and then secondarily deal with rural poverty.
When you get to those three to five final the candidates, how long do you think it will take then to dwindle that down to the person?
I don't think it'll take very long. It should not take very long. The people who are on this council and the people who are on the State Board of Education have direct experience with public education, and they can see people who have and see in people who have what they've been able to accomplish. I firmly believe that the best indicator of what a person can do is what a person has done. And if they've done it, then that's the person we need to have.
Will they come before the they will actually come before the council, do presentations, have obviously maybe an hour or two long interview with you all firing questions?
Yes.
Not like a, you know, congressional hearing quite, but
it may get that way, who knows. But yes, they will interview the 3 to 5 candidates will interview with the entire council and with the entire Board of Education. State Board of Education. And so I really believe that the collective wisdom of all of those individuals and the varied experiences that they have will enable us to pick the individual that would be best suited to both rural and urban populations in the state of Georgia. I don't want to be catty about it, but the last thing we need is someone who is only a political connection. We need someone who knows what teaching children in poverty is all about.
You've been in education for a long time, Dr. Stokes. Have you ever chaired something like this? And what's been the eye-opener for you in this experience?
No, I've not chaired anything like this. But I taught in two poverty schools in my public school career.
Where?
In Maury County, which was white poverty. We had about 95% free and reduced lunch when I was there. And then I was the principal of Green Tolliver High School, and we had 98% free and reduced lunch in a primarily African-American community.
So you know the plight and the quality of life that many of these kids are coming from.
Yes, and so do most of the people on this council. For example, I mentioned Ms. Kim Evans, who is the director of the Boys and Girls Club from Richmond County. She most certainly deals with that every day. On the council is, in addition to Dr. Gustafson, is Lex Rainey. Lex Rainey was the superintendent of the Gilmer County Schools. That's mountain white poverty for 10 years. He was the superintendent of schools. He knows what that segment looks like. You know, poverty has a very different face, and it has a most extraordinary impact on school performance. And there's lots of evidence to show that.
So my final question, Dr. Stokes, then when possibly could this new person, this new chief turnaround officer begin day one, walk into the office and say, I'm ready to go?
We're hoping that will be November the 1st. The folks from NASB have already scheduled to have them on a panel in the first week in November. So we're in serious hopes that we can complete this process of selecting the turnaround officer by the 1st of November. Then comes the chore of selecting the coaches, which are the folks that will work directly with the schools themselves.
And then the second week of November, you'll bring them here to closer look.
Well, I can't make any promises because I don't know who they are, and I don't know whether I would be able to have any influence with them. But I would certainly encourage them to come and speak with you.
I appreciate it. Dr. Jimmy Stokes, chairman of the state's Education Turnaround Advisory Council. He's also the executive director of the Georgia Association of Educational Leaders. Dr. Stokes, thanks for coming in and taking the time.
Thank you so much, Rose.
Really appreciate it.
Support for WABE comes from Reliable Heating and Air, a Trane dealer. A family company since 1978, offering heating and air, plumbing, electrical, and duct cleaning 24 hours a day. Learn more at ReliableAir.com.
As the new Mercedes-Benz Stadium opens later this month, we take a look. How will it change the local economy and neighborhoods on the west side? What were the past promises for Atlanta stadiums, and what's the current reality? Join WABE reporter Stephanie Stokes at our next community conversation, The Impact of New Stadiums, Tuesday, August 22nd at 6:30 at the Atlanta University Center's Woodruff Library. For more information and to reserve your free ticket, go to wabe.org/community.
You're listening to Closer Look. If you missed any of today's conversation, catch up on our website at wabe.org/closerlook. Again, wabe.org/closerlook. Also, we want to hear from you. Send our host, Rose Scott, an email, rose@wabe.org. This is 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR.
My name is Ann Nguyen, and I live in Stone Mountain. I like the shops. I like artists from there. I like the attractions and Stone Mountain Park. They have activities for kids. You know, they can practice and familiarize themselves with art, like pottery, painting. If I could change one thing about Stone Mountain, it would be traffic jam. It's really bad there.
Your days are busy.
Work, school, errands, kids.
It never stops.
And the news never stops either.
You can keep up between Morning Edition and All Things Considered with Here and Now. Hi, it's Robin Young.
And Jeremy Hobson. Here and Now brings you breaking news, developing stories, the latest in the arts and innovation.
Asking tough questions, unpacking complex issues.
From across the country and around the world.
Join us.
This afternoon at 3 on 90.1 WABE.
From AtlantaPlanet.org, here's a look at some upcoming events. This weekend is the 14th annual Atlanta Underground Film Festival. That's at Synchronicity Theater. And Saturday, it's the Butterfly Festival at Dunwoody Nature Center. You can step inside a tent filled with butterflies and go on a scavenger hunt. If you're looking for something to do in Atlanta, visit us at AtlantaPlanet.org.
My name is Dowie Dolman. I live in Tucker. I actually just moved to Georgia because of family, girlfriend, and a better opportunity for job-wise. My first impression is there's a lot more stuff you can do besides, you know, just staying at home. It's a lot of activities, you know. I would describe Tucker, Georgia as, you know, it's a spot where it's very convenient. You know, it's away from the expensive apartments in downtown Atlanta. It's cheaper, and also it's right where it's not busy, where the traffic is hectic.
And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. Maybe you count sheep. Maybe you drink chamomile tea or you listen to the soothing sounds of Kenny G. People will try just about anything to get a good night's sleep. Now, according to the American Sleep Association, about 50 to 70 million U.S. adults suffer from what they deem as sleep disorders. That could include just insomnia, sleep apnea, snoring, and more. There are many remedies for these conditions, but a new study could lead to a better understanding of how to fix some of these sleep ailments. Now, scientists understood that sleep is regulated by the brain. That's what they told us. But a new study from Morehouse School of Medicine suggests muscles play a big role in controlling sleep. Here to talk more about this is Dr. Christopher Ahlen. He's a neurobiologist and co-author of the study. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So everything we learned in school about the brain controlling sleep is wrong?
No, I don't think it's wrong. No, but we were definitely partially wrong. And we now think that muscle is probably plays a bigger role than we originally thought. We knew the body probably had some feedback mechanisms, mm-hmm. but the evidence we have suggests that it plays a pretty big role in regulating sleep amount.
We're going to get to that in just a second, but for just education purposes, let's just talk about the importance of sleep and how it does influence our overall health.
Right. Well, I think we're all pretty familiar with the experience that you have with insufficient sleep, with memory, mood, and concentration. So I probably don't have to tell you about those, but what many people probably don't know is that there's serious health consequences associated with insufficient sleep. So cancer, heart disease, diabetes, immune problems, weight gain, drug abuse, they're all been associated with insufficient sleep.
Depending on whom you ask, in terms of just how many hours of a good night's sleep does the body require or one require, you can ask someone, they say, oh, I only need maybe 5.5. Some will say 6. Some will say, I need 8. Mm-hmm. What do you recommend?
Yeah. So, well, first, I'm not a physician.
Okay. I know.
I
know.
All right. But it for adults, 7. So it depends on how old you are. If you're an infant, you need 18 hours of sleep. 12 to 18 hours. If you're a child, you need 10. Adolescents, 9. Adults, 7 to 9. It depends.
What made you all want to look at, first of all, sleep, and then take it further and say, well, let's look beyond the brain being the primary core of what regulates our sleep? What made you all dig into that?
Well, I'd like to give you some great story, but it was an accident.
Really?
Yeah. So we're interested in sleep regulation because, believe it or not, we really have no idea what sleep is for, what the biological purpose is. We know what the negative effects of sleep loss are. We know that almost every organism sleeps, but we don't really understand why it happens. And so as part of that, we're trying to understand what regulates sleep. And we know a lot about brain structures that regulate sleep. Mm-hmm. And we also knew that certain genetic mutations cause variations in sleep amount. And so that's where we started. There was a mouse that had a gene called BMAL1 turned off. Mm-hmm. And this mouse slept about 3 hours more than normal mice. And so we set off to figure out why that was. And as part of that, we did a control. And since BMAL1 is expressed all over the body, our control was to rescue it in skeletal muscle in this mouse where it's turned off, and then also rescue it in the brain. Because, you know, skeletal muscle is one of the biggest organs. It's encompasses a big part of the body. And what we found is that skeletal muscle was able to restore normal sleep amount. But when we did this, we rescued BMAL in the brain, it didn't restore normal sleep amount.
Well, you know, grow up, we're hearing, you know, you need to get your 8 hours. And often habit plays a role in that routine. What we do from when we're little to teenagers who apparently can only survive, I guess, on 2 hours of sleep, and then as an adult. But habit plays a role in this. So if the brain is not the regulator, and you're saying you don't know why we need to sleep, then how do you know that the brain is a regulator of it? And I hope that's not a simplistic question, but you threw me there when you said you don't know why we sleep.
Yeah, it surprises a lot of people, but it's why I have a job, basically. So we know a lot about the structures in the brain that cause vigilance. They cause you to be awake and they cause you to sleep. We know it's highly regulated, but we don't really know the purpose. There's theories about why we sleep, but and we know that it helps with memory and cognition. It helps with a lot of different processes. But
so going back to the mouse, does a mouse have a name?
No, there's several of them. Okay. They usually get numbers.
So going back to mouse number 628, and you're talking about the skeletal muscle, which is you're saying influences this natural sleep pattern.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Explain that a little further for me.
Oh, okay. All right. So what we do is we measure sleep amount in these mice. So we measure sleep by electroencephalography, EEG. You probably heard of that term.
Sure.
We put electrodes on the surface of the skull and measure the electrical activity of the brain. And so we can assess sleep states that way. And so these mice are genetically manipulated so that the gene is only rescued in the muscle or only rescued in the brain. So we take an animal where this gene is gone, mm-hmm. and then we put it back either in the muscle or in the brain. And because of the specificity of this technique, we know that it was only in the muscle. We obviously did some verification. And then we also had a different model, because we didn't believe it at first, where we took a normal mouse and we knocked out this gene only in muscle. And we saw that caused the same effect as knocking it out in the entire animal.
So so you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, then that the skeletal muscle was influencing the sleep pattern in the mice?
Right, yeah.
Okay, so now that you've got that data, and now y'all said, well, now maybe we can use this to determine or even come up with treatments for sleep disorders. Now, how do you get to that pathway?
Yeah, that's going to be a long road. I think it's going to take my lifetime. But
really?
Yeah. So it depends on how lucky we get, really. So the first thing we need to do is figure out the mechanism. So how is this happening? We have some ideas. There are circulating factors that are released by muscle into the blood and then can affect the brain. And so those are likely candidates. But we also know of some genes that are in the pathway that this BMAL1 gene is in that are also associated with differences in sleep amount. Going back to, you're talking about people that need different amounts of sleep.
Mm-hmm.
There's a certain mutation that causes short sleepers. So there are people that need less sleep because of this genetic mutation, and that gene is in this pathway with BMAL. So it could be that's so. If it is, then that would give us an obvious clue. But if it isn't, we might be looking a little longer.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about a study that suggests that sleep is controlled by muscle and not just by the brain. And we're speaking with Morehouse School of Medicine neurobiologist Christopher Ahlin. If it could take a lifetime to figure out the skeletal muscle influence on sleep, how long did it take you all to get to this point?
Oh, it depends on who you ask. 10 years, probably.
How many mice, man?
So it was a lot.
You mean, what's a lot?
It was a lot of work. I don't think I could give you a specific number.
But it took a long time. And researchers at Morehouse School of Medicine, did you all work with other medical institutions or research institutions?
Yes, and I wanted to be sure that I mentioned that. So this was a team. I didn't do it alone. And we worked with Joe Takahashi at UT Southwestern Medical School. He made a lot of the mice. He did the genetic mutations in a lot of these mice that we used. And obviously, we also needed the assistance of a muscle biologist, since we're all neuroscientists, mm-hmm. and that was Karen Esser at University of Florida. And then there were a bunch of people at Morehouse School of Medicine, Katema Paul, Jason DeBrine, Chloe Luckett, and a few others. So it took a team, and we've been working on it a long time.
Dr. Ahlin, as we wrap up, why, someone listening may say this, why is this so important to my quality of life? What can you all possibly do for me in my quality of life if I am someone that suffers from some type of sleep ailment or sleep disorder?
Right. Well, right now we have drugs to treat sleep disorders,
mm-hmm.
but honestly, it's it's not, they're not the best methods. So a lot of the drugs are what are called sedative hypnotics. So they cause sedation and they might not give you the most efficient sleep. And so knowing that this muscle plays a role, we obviously know that exercise has a role in, mm-hmm. in regulating sleep too, and there's been studies to do that. So this might provide an alternate pathway to target for drugs or for other interventions. We could target the muscle rather than the brain.
I have read so many different articles about things you can do to fall asleep. Can you train the brain to, in terms of your habit as a person, can you train the brain to just, I want to go to sleep and do it, brain? I know that sounds simplistic.
Yeah. You can do things to help you sleep. And the main things are light and environment and drugs. So you want to lay off the caffeine. Caffeine can stick with you for 12 hours. So cutting out caffeine, alcohol can interfere with sleep, so not using those things helps. Light during the night is seriously interferes with sleep, and that's a problem with a lot of people with devices. I know my kids now have all their homework on computers and phones, and they're always on devices late, and I'm always freaking out about it, and my wife thinks I'm a little bit crazy, but...
They've got a tablet somewhere next to them.
Yeah, but there are apps you can get to that adjust the frequency on your tablets and computer screens so that the frequency of the light that will have less of effect on your sleep. So I think those are the two main things. Get the TV out of the bedroom. That's
Dr.
a big
Alan.
One. I know. They're all easy things that are very – that we don't want to do, right? We all want to take a pill, you know. We don't want to do the things that we really need to do. And I'm the same way. I understand.
What's the next phase of this research for you all?
We're working to try and figure out the mechanism. So we're taking some of those candidates that I told you about, and we're going to try to investigate whether they are mediating this effect.
Explain it.
Well, so there are known factors that are released from muscle that act on the brain. Mm-hmm. And we look at those as likely candidates for things that might be signaling from the muscle to the brain. So if they signal one thing, maybe they signal something else. Mm-hmm. And we're going to start there. It's simplistic, but actually figuring out what that factor is going to be a lot of work. So you can do screens where you look in the blood between, you know, animals that have the mutation, animals that don't, and try to find the differences in all the factors in the blood.
But at this point, you'll still be working with animals. Will you get to a phase where you need clinical trials with people?
Yeah, that's way down the road. And we don't...
Is that too dangerous?
I mean, I don't think a lot of people would like themselves to, you know, have genetic mutations done on them.
No, I don't know a whole lot, no.
Yeah, I mean, eventually we might find drugs. So if we find a druggable target, then we could target, that same target in people. And it's something that could happen.
All right. Morehouse School of Medicine neurobiologist Chris Alen talking about a study that suggests that sleep is controlled by more than just the brain. Dr. Alen, fascinating stuff. Thank you.
Thanks. It was fun.
I appreciate it.
Mr. Sandman. Make him the cutest that I've ever seen. Bum, 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 bum. Give him two lips like roses and clover. Bum, 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 bum. Then tell him that his lonesome nights are over. Sandman, I'm so alone. Bum, 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 bum. Don't have nobody to call my own. Bum, 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 bum. Please turn on your magic beam. Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream. Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream.
Support for WABE comes from Comcast Business. Comcast is committed to providing dependable internet service for businesses who depend on it. Comcast Business, internet, voice, and TV, built for business. and from Jewish Kids Groups, a new kind of Hebrew school designed for Jewish families of all backgrounds, including interfaith, featuring experiential learning in a welcoming environment. More about Sunday and after-school programs at JewishKidsGroups.com.
You're listening to Closer Look. If you missed any of today's conversation, catch up on our website at wabe.org/closerlook. Again, wabe.org/closerlook. Also, we want to hear from you. Send our host, Rose Scott, an email at rose@wabe.org. This is 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR.
My name is Lee and I live in Midtown. I'd like to see more public transportation that goes out to the suburbs because I want to visit my family without having to hop in a car.
My name is May and I live in the Old Fourth Ward just behind the Edgewood Bars. I would love to see farmers markets and more daytime stores, like a corner store, something outside of the nightlife over there.
My name is Nasir. I live in East Point. I would like to see more community center, outreach centers in the community. You see a lot of youngsters, teenagers, walking around aimlessly, nothing to do, no jobs, no type of career training or something to lead them in the right direction. So I would like to see that in my neighborhood.
On the next Fresh Air, Eric Lipton, a Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter who covers corporate agendas and government relations. He's been investigating the extent to which the regulated have become the regulators in the Trump administration. He writes about industry lobbyists who are now in senior positions at many government agencies working to roll back regulations they once fought. Join us this afternoon at 2 on 90.1 WABE.
And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. Last week on the program, we devoted an entire hour to juvenile justice reform. We talked about efforts to review life sentences given to juvenile offenders, as well as initiatives to prevent youth from entering the system to begin with. We're going to follow up now with the profile of DeKalb County's juvenile diversion program. And joining me in studio to talk all about this is the Chief of Probation, Shonda Dean, and Valencia Breedlove, Program Administrator for the program. Thank you all for coming in.
Thank you.
Shonda, I want to start with you for a second. Take us through the process when a young offender first comes through the court system to begin with. Let's say they've been, you know, brought in for shoplifting or something like that. They're 13. And what is the typical process for this young person?
Once a youth is picked up, let's just say at Walmart, they're picked up for shoplifting. Mm-hmm. Law enforcement takes them into custody, contacts us, and brings them into our intake department where we actually enter the case into the system, finding out the specifics of what happened. And at that point, we determine, based on the situation, whether that kid is going to be held to go to court the next day or next few days or is released.
And those circumstances that could determine which of the outcomes will happen for that young person, usually does depend on if they are a repeat offender or what do you all look for? How do you gauge that?
Yes, we look at their juvenile history. If they have a previous history, depending on what those charges may be, can also determine whether that kid is released back to their parents or is held to go to court. So when we're looking at that, we're looking at the family dynamics. We're looking at whatever is going on in the home because we ask a series of questions to find out what's going on with that kid. There's also an instrument that we have to use to determine based on a scoring system, based on their history, based on what's going on, to decide if they're going to be held.
Can I ask what kind of questions you all are asking?
For example, school behavior. Mm-hmm. Are there any issues going on with this young man or young woman in the school? How is the relationship with the mother, the father, with the siblings, along with looking at those actual charges? Because the charge itself also is scored, and it's the scoring system that we use to determine whether they're held.
From that moment, for many offenders who have a history, it begins with them as a juvenile. For many, mm-hmm. you can see this pattern. Before you could even make the recommendation that they go through a diversion program, are there any other assessments they have to go through? Talk to the parents.
Yes, it is. Before, a lot of times before that, we'll actually send them through an orientation. We'll get the parents to come back in. We'll find out, like I say, what's going on with the family. And it may be a situation where we can just divert to counseling, mm-hmm. where we may not even actually put them on an informal type of supervision. And we also may decide, okay, well, this kid is having some issues with behavior, following the rules at home. So we may just send them through a court program for about 90 days. And once they complete the program, we close the case.
Valencia or Shonda, one of you can answer this. You said court program. What does that look like?
We have so many court programs. Mm-hmm. In that particular situation you're talking about, which would be a case that would be diverted, because if it's a shoplifting case, we can send them through our CHINS program, which is on Saturdays, where the kids get some skills, mentoring, just behavior classes, developing basically specific areas for basic life skills. Mm-hmm. We also, with our CHINS program, we have a parent piece. So the kids in class as well as the parents in class. So we're also still trying to make the family whole and healthy and not just dealing with the child. So we have a series of programs. We have mentoring mm-hmm. For young ladies. We have mentoring for young men. We have mentoring. 100 Black Men is one of our partners that partner with us and mentor our young men on Saturdays. We have Thinking for Change. This is a cognitive-based program. It's very intense. It's up to, I believe it's like 24 sessions that this kid has to go through twice a week, where they're actually dealing with problem solving, where they're trying to do cognitive restructuring of their thinking and the thought process.
And Valencia, all these programs are in place to, one, prevent the young offender from proceeding further down preventing them, showing them different options to take in terms of committing a crime. But do you also have some cases where parents may want them to experience the real experience, if you know what I mean, in terms of, I guess tough love? And we've seen all those reality shows, hard, life and all that.
Well,
think those programs work, where kids are thrown in a prison for a day and scared straight kind of type reality shows?
And just to be honest, I truly don't. I really believe that we're not here to do punitive damage mm-hmm. to the youth. What we are here to do is to help them to not come through the doors of the court programs and all of the youth diversion programs that we have, and just to give them some form of positive inclinations to move forward. And that's the whole game plan for the youth diversion program at the juvenile court that we have.
And the role that you play in the youth diversion program as the administrator, what are you doing?
So with the youth diversion program, we solicit volunteers in the community. These volunteers consist of retired judges, firefighters, teachers, community, business owners that live inside of the city of that youth, of where that youth lived. And what they do, they come out and volunteer and sit on a panel and hear the cases of the youth and the parent while they're there. Once they hear the cases, then they will give them a consequence. And the consequence can be very minute. It just depends on the youth and seeing exactly what kind of concerns and issues that they have. And they hear those cases, and these panel members do a great job in finding a way to gravitate to those kids.
Is there training for the panel members?
It is. It's a training that they have to go through. Also, we have to do background checks on each and everyone. They do have to observe panels for a long time frame. And once that's completed, then they can sit on a panel.
Shonda, let me ask you this. This particular program, I imagine, is not unique. There are a lot of programs around the state, around the nation that use this. But are you all working working from a particular model, a template, in terms of the DeKalb County's program here?
Not a particular model. It's just programs that we put together when we determine what the kids need, what the community needs, versus, like Ms. Breedlove is saying, versus being very punitive a lot of times with some of the less offensive charges. We don't want to criminalize them either. So we want to provide treatment. We want to counsel them. We want to just put programs in place. We want to mentor them because we're not trying to criminalize children.
Has this program been around long enough that you all can effectively gauge the how effective it's been?
Yes. It's been around for...
Since 1992. We've been
on... You have a lot of success stories.
Yeah.
The volunteers that come in, do you need more volunteers? Because that, for someone to take time out of their schedule to come in, they're going to sit on a panel. And they not only sit on a panel and listen to the youth and maybe the parent, but also then make recommendations and also give sort of a life consequences speech, so to speak. Do you have trouble getting more volunteers? How do you reach more people out in the community to come in, someone like me or one of my colleagues?
Well, what we do, we utilize the volunteers that we have already, word of mouth. Also, I go out into the community, I talk with teachers, I talk in the schools, and we go out in the community as well, community centers, and places like here. But we just did a large a swearing in of volunteers. But hey, in the near future, we would love to have you to come in, volunteer to speak, observe. We would love to have you to come
and help shape some young minds.
See what we do. Yep.
Shonda, how important is this program? And you know, programs need funding, obviously. Is that something you probably don't have to deal with the money aspect of it, but how important is this program?
It is very important. And right now, for this particular program, we don't use any funding for it. Like she says, we have the volunteers there that come in to volunteer. My staff, the staff is permanent staff that is paid through the county. So we're hearing the cases, they're hearing the cases, they're volunteering their time. So we don't use any fund. There's no funding to fund this particular program.
Does your data suggest that for the kids that go through the diversion program and that you are reducing those recidivism rates? Do you, you see that? You have concrete data that suggests that?
Yes, we do. We do. Matter of fact, I was looking at some data just this week with our judge. So, and we were looking at the charges with the felonies versus the misdemeanors and how the charges are actually going down from year to year. So we're trying to make sure we're providing more intervention. We're getting them on at the gates, so to speak. We're getting them in the schools. I have officers in every school in DeKalb. So we're partnering with them so that if any kid is having any issue at the school, we're right there. We can deal with that issue. We can even sometimes do the intervention and prevent a case necessarily being filed against that child at our court.
And if the young offender goes through the program and gets some glaring remarks, are they removed from the system? There's nothing that could come down the line and come back and
their cases are sealed.
How satisfying is that for when they know that?
Yes, that, you know, because if they come back and anybody can pull their history, the cases are sealed. It's nothing there. So if they complete, they successfully complete, case closed, sealed, no one has access to that.
Valencia, you interact with some of these youth?
I do.
What do they tell you after they go through the programs?
They're happy to be done. But just being able to have a mentor, someone to call and talk with them, because we do have mentors on the panel that sit down and talk with them throughout the week on a certain time of day. And it helps them to be able to communicate effectively and talk and be able to talk in front of people. And that has helped a lot of the kids that I've dealt with. When I see them in the schools, they're like, hey, Ms. Breedlove, I'm doing well. And I think that's the best thing that we love to hear and see here in DeKalb County.
For some of the youth that you're not able to reach or to help or who can't go through the program, what's the likely outcome for them?
Wow. That do not go through the diversion program, I mean, it can be anywhere. It can be funeral. It can be their life, life choices, bad decisions, you know, in their life. We're losing a lot of kids, a lot of young people these days because of the choices that they make.
And you're seeing kids at a very young age even enter the juvenile court system. We did this issue last week, and someone mentioned as young as seven.
Yes, it is. And we typically try to divert those cases, but our age range is from 10 to 17 for the criminal charges. So when you're talking about a kid for the age of 7, we're actually probably going to get some other outside agencies mm-hmm. involved, whether it's DFACS or whatever it is, to try to assist us with finding out what is actually going on with that family.
Wow. Chief of Probation Shunda Dean and Valencia Breedlove, Program Administrator in DeKalb County's Juvenile Diversion Program. Thank you all for coming in and sharing the success stories of your program. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
And if I have time, maybe I'll be a mentor.
Yes, we love to have you.
That's it for today's edition of Closer Look, which is produced by Candace Wheeler, Ebony Lemon, Finley Foxen. Our engineer is Elizabeth Eads. Our executive producer is Christine Dempsey. Thanks to the entire WAB News team, as well as Public Broadcasting Atlanta's Digital Services crew. If you missed any of today's show, you can find their entire program at wabe.org/closerlook. You can now listen to Closer Look weeknights at 9 p.m. I'm Rose Scott. Stay tuned to 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR.